these people know what they're talking about, listen to them and stop resisting.
If I was to do anything differently, I probably wouldn't be here. Welcome to A Tale of Three Indies podcast. If you like what you hear, you can follow us on Twitter at Three Indies or on Facebook and SoundCloud at Tale of Three Indies. So, anything happening?
You do that far better than I do. That nice intro.
I have it written down, Keen. I read it out. Yeah. Literally just read it out.
Well, actually, Dawn, the last time I did it, I read it out, and it didn't sound as good as that. but nobody notices, I'm sure. My complete
I find you do have to write it down, otherwise you suddenly forget your own name.
Yes, it's Keen. Yeah, that's great.
Yes, Keen. Antonia. Dawn.
Gonna need one of those tattoos of my name on there. Just to remind myself.
Yeah, we should put our names in marker across our foreheads.
Anything interesting happen? Have you met anyone interesting? Because I've accosted someone interesting recently.
Oh, yes. Tell us a story about accosting a famous Irish crime fiction writer.
Be careful around crime writers, Keen.
I know, yeah. There's the most dangerous people around.
Yeah. I think if you're going to accost somebody, go for a romance writer or a children's writer.
Well, I don't know. That might not work out either.
I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. Okay, children's writer. Let's go children's.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the writer I did accost was Liz Nugent. And in the nicest possible way, I accosted her. What happened was I was at an event and she was there and I spotted her. I was like, oh, I must go and chat to Liz later on. I turned around and she was leaving. I was like, oh no, crap. I wanted to talk to her. I wanted to tell her a story, basically, because I will forever link Liz and Three Little Cruelties, or Our Little Cruelties, whatever I call it, Three Little Cruelties, Our Little Cruelties, with the start of the pandemic.
Yeah.
She was on Ryan Tuberty, like, I don't know, was it the day before or the couple of days before the lockdown? And her book that book had just launched. And our delivery never arrived on time. And then, of course, everybody wanted it. And everything shut down. We couldn't get the book. And
I remember.
Scrambling, trying to get copies of it. I think, Dawn, I might have swapped Hilary Fannin.
Yeah. Yeah, we did a swap.
We did a swap.
Or was it Carmel Harrington?
Was it Carmel Harrington? I can't remember the why, but I certainly had more copies. And there was a swap. There was a completely legal within our 5K or whatever it was swap. Nobody draw circles between.
I think we had those post labels at the time. Yeah,
that was the post label, the offer. Yeah, we did post them. That's true. No. Yeah, sorry, it was completely legal.
Yeah, Liz is great.
So don't investigate us.
Liz came to Hinterland 1 year as a guest and has become a part of the festival ever since, because now she either comes back if she has a new book as a guest or she comes to interview. So she was at this year's festival to interview Val McDermott. So, Liz is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. She's a new book coming out. That's been announced, right?
It's
announced.
Yeah, she had it on her social media.
Okay, not so exclusive.
It's not out till 2023 anyway, but yes, it is coming out.
March. Yeah, March 2023. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. Can't wait. We'll have to get her onto the podcast, definitely.
Yeah, a much more relaxed feeling around this one.
Should all have big stocks of it anyway.
And if anything goes wrong, we can blame Liz that she seems to bring on a pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, Liz.
So, what else is going on?
Anything else happening?
We're school book season.
Yeah, school books. Just completely school books.
I was listening to the radio there recently and someone was talking about, school books and they were exclaimed, it started already? I was like, it started for us months back. We have to deal with this longer than any of you people do.
Yeah. And it will continue after you've got your school books as well.
Yeah.
And some people are always surprised when you say that you're busy already because they're not thinking of ordering their school books till August. But like really, people, get your book list in now.
Get your book list
books
in
go
now.
Into reprint and in August you might not be able to get them all.
Some of them are already being reprinted.
Yep. They are.
We've already had shortages.
Don't.
But sorry.
Don't. I can't even start on that road. I am so livid about it.
No.
There are phone calls to be made. And I need to calm down about the whole situation of books already just in June.
I know. I think we understood better in 2020 and maybe even last year. But this year it's like, okay, really, seriously, people, get a bit more organized.
Last year, it was exceptional or circumstances, I would have thought.
I don't know if you guys got the phone call, but I got the phone call and I won't name them, but a certain school book publisher deciding to do a stock take this Friday.
Yes.
I was like, why would you do that now?
Yeah, surely it should have been done in May at the latest.
Okay. Anyway. Yeah, I think I'll close my shop
one of their books was
to do a stock take.
Was printed with the wrong cover, so that the ISBN is wrong. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't hear that one.
Sorry, Keen.
Fun.
Let's
There's
talk
always
about something
fun,
else.
Fun things to deal with.
It's like the Leaving Cert nightmare that just keeps coming back every year.
Every year.
And it gets
the waking
stretched
nightmare.
Out longer and longer and longer.
Yeah, my
it starts
staff.
In April and ends in November.
Yeah, remember, and then, yeah, I thought it was just me, but I know my staff come in August and they're like, oh, I had this dream last night that we gave the wrong books to someone, or we did this or we did that. So I think it's just you eat, sleep and drink school books for July and August.
It's peak school book season.
PTSD.
That's what it is. And we put a lot of hard work and effort into your school books, people. So please be nice to us in August when
maybe
we're
nobody
very
wants
tired.
To hear about school books.
Yeah, let's go back to regular books.
Yes,
the
exactly.
Things that people want to hear about.
So who do we have today, Dawn?
We have Michelle Gallen. Very exciting. Michelle studied English literature at Trinity College in Dublin and won several prestigious prizes as a young writer. And following a devastating brain injury in her mid-20s, she co-founded three award-winning companies and won international recognition for digital innovation. And apart from all of that, Michelle's first novel, Big Girl, Small Town, was shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award, Newcomer of the Year Award at the An Post Irish Book Awards, and the Comedy Women in Print Award, and lots of other awards. But her new book, Factory Girls, it was published on 23rd of June, and we've all read it, and it is amazing. So here's the interview.
Michelle, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. I read your first book, your first novel, Big Girl, Small Town, which I always called Big Town, Small Girl. It doesn't matter. I just have to do it around in my head, around and around again. Anyway, in 2020, during the first lockdown, it was one of our book club books. It was actually, I think, one of our first online book club books. But so much of that publicity must have been online because it was released in February 2020. Are you looking forward to getting out and doing more of the in-person stuff?
I don't know. I'm terrified. I think that I think I had one of the last traditional book launches before COVID hit. And we were kind of watching, it felt like me and my husband were big into seeing, like tracking COVID in, you know, when it first appeared. And it just felt like a storm gathering and was about to hit us. And I think after we launched in Dublin, I got to do a launch in Belfast and then we had to fly to London. And I remember refusing to go on the public transport that wasn't a boat. I was on the deck of the boat in the freezing cold in February going, yeah, no, I'm not going indoors because COVID. And I think maybe it was about a week later, everything closed down and the schools were closed and stuff. So
for 2 weeks.
Yeah. You know, at this stage, we kind of knew it wasn't going to be 2 weeks. So now I'm trying to organize a book launch for Dublin and for Belfast. And I'm inviting people and I'm just like, is this going to happen or is the meteorite going to strike? You know, what's going to be next this time?
Well, it's monkeypox now, isn't it?
Monkeypox, yeah.
It is the new one, only for monkeypox, I believe you have to get quite up close and personal. And I think Hodges Fidges have a policy against that.
It's surely big enough to space people out.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's corners of Hodges Fidges where people get up close and personal. But
just don't have your book launch
think
there.
About that.
Sacred ground, it's a bookshop. Don't be saying that, Keen. Sorry.
And I am really thinking about reading corners and nooks and you know, I'll never go in a bookshop without thinking bad things. Oh.
Yeah, you've ruined that image now.
Go and clean all the corners now, Keen. Thank you. But You had the story for Big Girl Small Town for 10 years, and it started off as a short story with a male protagonist, and this was all before it was picked up by a publisher. What made you stick with that story for so long?
Oh my God, I don't know when to let go of things. When I wrote the short story, as soon as I finished it, I knew that I wasn't done with the world, and I was really busy in work, but I had the great advantage of just taking a month off. I was a freelancer, and I was able to like shutter everything for a month. And I pretty much wrote the book in a month, 70,000 words, and took maybe about 3 years to finish the rest of it because, you know, I have scatterbrain. I can do hyper-focus, but then after that, I'm like, ooh, and I ran around doing lots of different things. And I tried to get a publisher, but it was... What I found was the closer I came to home on trying to get a publisher, the less interested I got. You know, I was getting the very standard, no, we're not interested. The further I went, like when I was targeting agencies in New York or London, I was getting this really warm feedback. And I think that kept me going because everybody kept saying, we love the world and we love the characters and, you know, the story, it's really original. But, you know, what's wrong with Magella was this question I got back quite a few times. And I was like, there's nothing wrong with Magella. She's perfectly normal. So it took me a long time because I feel with publishers, you need to be able to give them a strong answer to their question. And when a female relative of mine got a relatively late diagnosis of autism, I decided to read up on the female presentation because I was really familiar with the male presentation at this stage. You know, my male relatives get diagnosed early, supported early, everything's done. When I read about the female presentation, I went, oh, okay, that's Magella, and yeah, and maybe me. And it was this big light bulb moment for me that I recognized that I'd written a neurodiverse character without knowing it, because neurodiversity is very common in the circle in which and in the family I grew up in. So it's kind of like Magella was it was a portrait of an undiagnosed autistic woman by an undiagnosed autistic woman. So that was quite a thing to find out. But once I had that, I was able to it was brilliant. I did a last rewrite of the book, like a polish up of the manuscript, but I just let Magella be completely Magella. And I got her the list that was just in my head went into the book, and all, you know, all of that just was let out of the genie was out of the bottle, I suppose. And it made it really easy to pitch because I was at the novel fair, which meant, you know, so I entered the novel fair with a manuscript. I was one of the finalists. I got to meet like 15 agents and publishers in one day in a beautiful Georgian building on the, you know, up in Parnell Square. So energy was high, completely prepped, and just really like just in the zone for it, you know. It was easy to pitch at that point. Loved it.
And was the process very different for Factory Girls? Like if you wrote Big Girl, now I'm going to say it backwards. Thanks,
Sorry.
Like you say, you wrote the bulk of Big Girl Small Town in a month and then 3 years to edit, you know, with all of these things about Magella. Was it different with Factory Girls? Did it take longer or was it the same?
Oh, I suppose it's like, when do you think I started it, you know? So I had the idea for the book in, I would say, 1997, 98. So like last
century. So longer than a month then.
Right.
So what happened was, like, I really did work a summer in a shirt factory, and you know, it was quite an intense environment, and quite a few things did go wrong when I worked in the shirt factory, but it was also incredible fun, very intense, one of these sort of summers that gets seared on your memory. And after I left college, I was like, I would really love to write about it. And I had this idea that I would, you know, my first book would be something like this, you know, set in a factory and featuring people who were like trying to get out. And then I got a brain injury. Like I got encephalitis. That was the summer of, well, the autumn of 98. So like my whole plan for my first book fell apart. And then Magella became my first book because it felt like an easier book to do simply because I could see it all in my head. With Factory Girls, I didn't even start it until I had my second kid. Like, so he was born in 2015. And it's 2022 now, right? So he's seven. But after he was born, like I had a perfectly fine birth, but I almost died afterwards. And so I had this 3 weeks in hospital where everything was very sort of like intense and everything felt very, I was like, you know, what do I want to do when I get out of here? And I was like, well, I want to write that book. But it has taken what, it took maybe 5 years to write it, I guess. So I started it that year with the baby that never stopped screaming, as I call my second son. And it took me a long time to kind of cobble it together, because when you're two little kids, and I think we moved country, moved jobs, did a whole lot of stuff in between. It wasn't until the Arts Council of Ireland gave me a bursary, just in the mouth of the pandemic. And the bursary was supposed to allow me to step back from childcare responsibilities and also my tech job. Like, I got a very demanding role in tech. And in the event, it allowed me to drop my tech job, which gave me more time to do the homeschooling we had to do in the pandemic. So really, I got to finish the book, thanks to the Arts Council grant, the time it bought me. But I was also homeschooling at the time. So I'm not able to make all the trips to Northern Ireland and to, like, my stomping ground that I had assumed I would be able to get. So yeah, this book wasn't easy either, I guess.
Oh, well, that's a long time as well for it to have been simmering around, you know, in the background. So is the story that we have the way it originally was when you came up with it in 1997, or has it changed, you know?
It's pretty much the same. I mean, it's a lovely compressed timeline again, right? It's girls who finish their exams, and then they take, the only job they can get is in a shirt factory, and it's a very deprived town, so they're really lucky to get work at all. And suddenly, like, you've gone from no money to a tiny amount of money, but you're trying to save, you're trying to have fun. Like, there's new people in the factory, like, similar to my experience. I'd gone to an all-Catholic primary, all-Catholic secondary, like, all-Catholic church. And suddenly then I got thrown into a shirt factory where you were thrown up against the people that you did live with, like, lived side by side with these people, but you'd never, ever met them because the whole system in which you'd grown up in was so segregated. So all of that's very much had been there from the start. And then this kind of timeline where, you know, you're ticking down to your exam results and it's the only thing you care about. But interestingly, in the book, the girls don't realize they're ticking down to the IRA ceasefire, which did become the big story of that summer. You know, it did become the thing that, as if we all knew it was going to happen, when in fact, even when it did happen, I do remember quite a few people being incredibly cynical that it wouldn't anyway last. So all of that's very, very much, it sat there. All of that nearly told its own story. But yeah, I rewrote the ending. Thankfully, the first ending was not as cheerful as the second ending is. So I think the ending is something that is important for a book. I know that when I wrote Big Girl, Small Town, I had a very sort of open-ended ending. And a lot of readers were like, no, but tell me what happens at the end. And I suppose I'm hoping that readers will have a stronger sense of satisfaction with this ending, I hope.
Yeah, I like the end of Big Girl, Small Town. It left it up to you to... It was hopeful, but you could fill in the gaps yourself at the same time.
And I think that's, like, if you're the sort of person who can almost imagine the next step, I think it is really satisfying for you to be the person that can make the decision. But I think for somebody who prefers just, like, I know if I go to a restaurant, I really hate going to those restaurants where they go, here's a flamethrower, now you have to grill your own steak. Yeah. And I'm going, no, bring me the steak and chips and pour my gravy on top and then go away. Yeah. I can see both
sides. That is a very good point, Michelle. I hate going to a restaurant and cooking my own food. So what you're actually making me do is read a book and write my own ending, which I'm going to have to pull you up on that one.
No, so I can completely see both sides of the story there. And sometimes I think it can be a lazy thing if you don't, like, make your ending satisfying enough. So I'm hoping this ending is satisfying. I feel like I'm saying satisfying enough. Too much, maybe not enough.
you've got food on the brain now.
I do. It's supper time. I'm missing my supper right now.
I'm going to jump. I had another question here, but it was something you mentioned there, and something that's come up recently for me. We're about to start into a book, which I won't mention the name of yet, or at all maybe, for the book club. And there's a neurodiverse character written, and it's written by someone who, as far as I'm aware, is not neurodiverse. Do you have an opinion on that, as to whether, you know, the rights and wrongs of it?
I think it depends on what you're going for. So, I mean, I think there's the curious incident of the dog in the night, which I loved. And I think of it as a beautifully written story. I know that the Eleanor Oliphant is absolutely fine. Another story that people have kind of talked about as not being maybe a documentary style, nitty gritty, realistic representation. And I think for me, it depends on how the book is being sold. If somebody sold me the curious incident of the, you know, the dog in the night as a completely photorealistic painting of, you know, an autistic boy, you would be disappointed. And I suppose what it is it's easier now for neurodiverse authors to write about, to create a neurodiverse character, and then they have a platform on which they can sell. I think before that you couldn't. I prefer to read something that's been, say, a complex neurodiverse character that's been written by a neurodiverse author. I think that the richness that you would get, the nuances I would pick up from that would be really satisfying. There's that word again. But I also know that if I'm reading something I don't know a lot about, I'm probably don't have the sort of, do you know what I mean? I probably don't have the knowledge to appreciate the depths of something. So this is about the depths of the characterization. For me, as a neurodiverse person, the more complex the character is and the more realistic and believable the representation is, the better I'm going to like it, which means I would really like to read something by a neurodiverse author. But I have enjoyed many books that, you know, use neurodiversity, but the author has researched it or observed it from somebody in their life.
Yeah, because it's more nonfiction, I think. Well, in my experience, by neurodiverse authors like Dara McAnulty, or is it Emma Mitchell, the Wild Remedy? But they seem.
I don't know, yeah. Emma's. I don't know Emma's book, but I know Dara's is. I think what might be interesting is who's diagnosed and who's not as well. I mean, and I think as well, I to be honest, if I could, I think I would probably make writers just of numbers, and then we don't have to go through book launches and we don't have to have you put in bookshelves with your name underneath. I think the product or the book, the artifact, is the most interesting thing. And if that's compelling and feels honest and representative, as long as it's not, I don't know, cannibalizing somebody else's actual authentic lived experience, then that to me is really valuable. I just think that in terms of publishing, there's never enough opportunities for people. And if you come from, you know, say a minority, or if you come from, you know, say a neurodiversity that isn't properly represented, it can feel a bit hard if somebody jumps on a bandwagon.
Yeah, and you don't want to be pushed out because somebody more famous or more polished or whatever gets in there and takes the space that could have been yours.
As we've learned, you know, they kind of, publishers, or as we've talked about a few times, publishers kind of only have enough space for certain things. So I suppose if another author is getting pushed out because I've already got that covered, you know, that's where maybe it starts to really become a problem.
I think, though, there's a big conversation to be had there around publishing as a whole. I mean, we talk about publishers having finite resources and bookshelves having finite, or bookshops having finite shelf space. I think actually bookshops can't stock all the books, but publishers do tend to make an enormous amount of money. Is there an argument here that either they spend more and have more books? Is there an argument that they spend less on some people and give other authors more money? There's a big thing. I walk in a bookshop and I go, I could never read all these books in what's left of my life if I tried. So I see how a bookshop can only have a certain number of books in it. But when I look at publishers and I look at how big their profits are, and then you look at how poorly paid people in publishing are, and then you look at authors, something doesn't stack up on that side. Something feels illogical to me on that side.
Yeah, could they refine their offering and maybe have a smaller number of books but much higher quality?
Well, book publishing is a bit like horse racing, though, isn't it? Like, you have 10 horses and you're like, oh, sure, we don't know which one's going to win. We'll put a quid in all of them and hope for the best. Or we think this one here is quite good, so we'll maybe give that one £5 and then hope that it doesn't fall. I mean, it is a case of one or two, or the celebrity authors really making the money that allows them to take a punt on something as, you know, eccentric as Big Girl, Small Town. And I appreciate that. But there is something when you look at those big, big profits, you know, the profit margins, if you go way back even from that and you look at the big business, it's an interesting numbers game.
And you mentioned earlier that when Big Girl, Small Town was, when you were trying to generate interest about it, that there wasn't very much interest. But do you think things have changed since then? And do you think it has anything to do with Anna Burns winning the Booker Prize, that there's now an appetite for stories from Northern Ireland?
I think trying to pitch anything from Northern Ireland after a certain point in the 90s was just excruciating, you know. I think as well, there very much was a culture of it's the men who were saying the important
serious things.
Serious things were being said by serious men. And I, you know, that was quite hard to overcome. I would attribute a lot of interest in what's coming out of Northern Ireland to both Anna Burns and to Lisa McGee. I think they both did a really great job of kind of going. I mean, I think Milkman is very dark, but hilarious. I think it's like just bitingly funny. It's a book that took me months to read because I just kept being ambushed by it. I just couldn't. One minute I'd be laughing and the next minute I'd be like, I'm putting you away in a drawer for, it's probably 3 weeks and then I'm going to come back to you.
But were you not tense the whole way through? It was like you could feel the tension while you were reading it the whole time.
It was really triggering. It really was a book that was just so terribly hard to read and so brilliant and so funny as well. Like I just felt it in my bones when I was reading it. And so I mean Anna Burns clearly did an amazing job with that. And then Lisa McGee manages to put, you know, Northern Irish schoolgirls onto the TV screen, and it's not just something that people in the UK and Ireland watched. It became this massive, like, just touchstone of joy and, you know, the shared stuff we all have, where you're just trying to go through your wee life and do your wee things, and they're the same things that everybody wants to get, you know, everybody wants to get up, well, not get out of where they are, but become who they want to be. And I think, you know, she managed to do that in a setting that really isn't traditionally associated with, you know, any real individuality or being allowed to become what you want to become. So I think the two of those made it easier for people to have a conversation with somebody from Northern Ireland again. And a conversation that wasn't, how can we put Liam Neeson in the movie of your book? You know, you always had to write something that would let Liam Neeson look sort of sweaty and hot and run around with a gun, you know. Pierce Brosnan's another one, yeah. Well, we keep going on the hot men who need guns.
Well, Liam did manage to make it into Derry Girls.
He did. He snuck in at the very end.
There is one scene in the book where, you know, the shirt factory, they're Catholics or Protestants. It doesn't really matter when you're in work. But there is one scene where they're all going out to the pub and the boss has booked this pub for the evening, which is a Catholic pub. So the Protestants aren't very happy about this. So I know you say that you worked in a shirt factory yourself. When you moved to Dublin then, did you find it totally different to suddenly just not have to think about things like that?
Ooh, did I suddenly stop thinking about it when I moved to Dublin though? No. So I moved to Dublin when I was 18, and I went from, you know, what was back then allegedly the most bombed small town in Western Europe after the, you know, the Second World War to Trinity College Dublin. And yeah, it was such a hard thing to do. It was such a different world, and people had a lot of attitude about the North and not very much, in general, there wasn't very much knowledge. So I'm trying to think that just going to a pub, I guess all it ever is you're swapping out one other for a new other. I mean, Trinity has this thing with UCD. Oh my God, he's not from UCD. Or even worse, you know, what was it, Portobello College? This idea that you're always like, we're the special people and we're dead right and everything we do is perfect. And they're just like mad, those people over there. And broadly speaking, in Ireland, everybody's almost identical anyway. but we take this great interest in saying, oh no, Tyrone is totally different to Fermanagh. And Derry, like, I mean, Derry girls, nothing like us Tyrone girls. We're just like totally different species. And you're just going, I think in Trinity, all it was it. I do remember finding it really irritating that people thought we had a problem, but without in any way having a sort of any self-reflection on what it is to be Irish and to be in Trinity College Dublin. And I can remember one person saying to me, you know, he said, if I could take a big saw and saw it off and just push it into the ocean, I would. And I was like, you're the future of Ireland and that's your best plan. Jesus, you got the points to get to Trinity and this is what you're coming up with.
Now sitting in the door for Fine Gael or something.
Probably. Yeah. So.
But it is something that you know, it was a very one-dimensional view of the North down here when I was growing up. And I definitely think a lot of the books that I've read recently, the aforementioned Derry Girls, things like that, like it's painting a picture of just normal life and a reminder then that it was normal life going on. You know, but it's another recurring theme that we've seen in a lot of these things, and we see it in Factory Girls. Maeve is planning to go to university in London, and many of the books and many of the TV shows and everything, it's all about getting out and escaping. Was this the expected path for anyone who had the option to do this?
I remember when I was 13, my mum bought me and my sister, we were 13 and 14, and she bought us plane tickets to New York, and she sent us on a plane unaccompanied to live for 2 months with relatives we'd never met because she wanted us to see there was life outside of the North. And, you know, I mean, it was an amazing experience and it was completely different, but then you always came back and you really did, like, all the peace trips they sent you on, all the things they tried to put you on were all designed to tell you that your life wasn't normal and it wasn't good enough and everything that you were doing was bad and ugly. And that's an awful lot to throw on kids who didn't start the fight in the first place. You know, it's an awful lot that adults used to turn around and put their hands up in the air and go, oh, we failed, but you're the future, go make it work, go make it bright and shiny. And, you know, I was one of those people who was brought up to leave. And, you know, many, many Catholics in particular were brought up with that kind of, like, you know, get up, get educated, get out sort of like attitude. But it's, I think one of the things that I'm interested in is where do you ever belong after that? When I moved to Dublin here after living in London and having my kids in London, my husband's French Moroccan, and I said to him, do you think you're going to feel at home in Dublin? Do you think, you know, are you going to be okay when we all move to Dublin? Like, we've got these English kids and you're French Moroccan. Are you going to be able to settle in the Republic of Ireland? And my husband was like, it's probably going to be easier for me than it's going to be for you. And I was like, oh.
Mic drop.
Oh, and you know, I think they integrated easier because they know less.
But they're also coming with less.
Is that what you were?
No. It wasn't actually. It was the other way around. Is that we have the baggage when we hear a Northern Irish accent?
There was less baggage for my English children with their, you know, what, you know, some people would have thought of were offensively English accents, and you know, my French Moroccan. That's all fine, but see Michelle there coming down with a Nordic accent. What's that about? Like, there's so much more attitude for that, and he was right. It's how do you integrate anywhere? And for me, being in London, I think broadly speaking nowadays, people don't care that you're Irish in London. We got over the bombing campaigns. Now as peace, they've moved on to other things. But I think there is still, I suppose for Ireland, when there is a conversation that seems to be swirling around reunification or unification, I suppose who is Irish and who should count as being Irish matters an awful lot more down here than it matters anywhere else. And so it's easier to integrate somebody who's, say, English or French or, you know, from wherever, really. I would say that it's almost easier for properly foreign cultures to be integrated than, say, I would love to see how we're going to integrate Orange Bands into the St. Patrick's Day Parade, for example. I would like to see how we're going to welcome unionists. I'm really interested in what the idea of Ireland is, because I grew up feeling that despite my Irish passport, I wasn't properly Irish. And, you know, that's a big question that I think Northern Irish people do have, no matter where they, no matter what passport they're holding, is, you know, where do we belong?
I find it interesting that in a lot of those conversations, it doesn't take long for a person with nationalist views to almost, you know, flip things around, and we're back to 1960s with, you know, oh no, but they're not, we're not letting them march their bands, and they're not going to have their flags, and, you know,
it's not that kind of,
it doesn't take much for us to suddenly jump into the, well, we're the dominant force now, so you can like it or lump it.
Yeah, I was at a St. Patrick's Day parade in Sligo there. It's the first time we got the kids out to one, and there was tractors, there was the Indian Society, there was belly dancing, there was people with, I don't know, you know, the people who
Brazilians, there's always Brazilians.
The whole thing was so vibrant, and a big old mix of GAA and hurls coming down the street at you, and, you know, then somebody with sequins, and, you know, like, it was amazing. And I was like, going, where are the orange bands? Go on, there's got to be one. We're right in the border here. It's like, it's not too far away, but is there any representation here? And there wasn't. It's, I don't know, it's, I think there's a conversation to be had about, you know, I just from where I grew up and being told who you are and what you're entitled to, you know, I think factory girls are in the book. There are four girls, or there are three girls, and they're very clearly told what they are and aren't allowed to be, and who they're allowed to be, and what they're entitled to dream of, and where they're going to go. And, you know, it's not a big wide open, you can be anything. And the idea of either being British or Irish, neither of those nationalities are big enough to contain these girls' dreams, because, you know, I suppose European is the nationality that feels most hopeful to me, United Europe rather than
but
United Ireland.
But I think books
Ireland.
Like yours, and as we said, we've read a lot of books recently, definitely set in Northern Ireland. I think more books, as Cian said, it's shown real life in Northern Ireland growing up, and it's us that comes with the baggage, because we grew up with, I think people outside of Ireland see Ireland as a small little island that you should know everything about everything, but we really didn't. We saw all the negatives on the news.
It's just bad news all the
time. So we didn't really know what, yeah, exactly. We didn't know what it was like to grow up in Northern Ireland. So I think books like yours are showing us, it was differences, obviously, but it was still... It was still a teenager growing up.
Olivia Fitzsimons' book, The Quiet Whispers Never Stop, and The Troubles With Us, Alex O'Neill, and the same kind of themes, even though they're very different books, they're all teenage girls just trying to be teenagers, but that's just a backdrop. There's a backdrop of living in the north that is just a little bit different, but it's not their main concern. It's just something that they're used to.
You don't want it to be your main concern, I think, is part of it, and that you have this dream that maybe you can go away and make yourself new again, or make the you happen, the you that you feel, that it might happen in a different place or in a different time. And I think a thing I tried to capture in the book, though, is that the girls are all really intensely living their lives, right? They're really full of it. They're like, oh my God, you know, we're going to go out tonight to watch the football. We might get shot, but we're going to go out to watch the football because Ireland's playing. And you're going, yeah, that's quite a complex statement. And I hope you don't get shot. So there's this, I suppose there's an intensity to growing up in any situation, like north, south, wherever it is. If there's some sort of conflict or some sort of, I don't know, danger or something that's stifling you. I think I really like these, I've completely forgotten the word. No, crucible. You know, when you got like a crucible and it's like a small space and you put everything in, and, you know. So I am going to be interested to see what sort of literature comes out of the pandemic, because I don't know what everybody's experience of the pandemic was, but we'd moved here. We didn't have a strong social network. And then suddenly it was like, no, you have no social network and a 2 kilometer area in which you can exercise. And it was like, wow. And you know, this idea that you're really thrown into such a small little goldfish bowl of, you know, running around your 2K and trying not to breathe on complete strangers that you're seeing every day, but you can't talk to. So I mean, there's another kind of sort of intense situation that I think that the literature that comes out of that might be very interesting as well.
In 20 years' time, there'll be just those touchstones of mentioning those things as the teenagers are trying to live their normal lives.
Yeah, and they'll be like, what pandemic? Or else we'll all be dead of the next one. I'm not quite sure. Will there be any readers left?
Well, listen, Michelle, thank you very much. I think we're going to have to wrap it there.
If you want to ask any lighter questions, I feel that I have been working on very intense political type things recently.
That's been good. If you want lighter
questions, I'm more than happy to stay on so you can edit out my political tirades. And why can't we all just be friends?
Not at all. No, political tirades are fun.
I'll
ask you this. Big Girl, Small Town was optioned for TV in 2020. Has there been any progress with it? Can you say if you know?
So I'm working on the development of the Big Girl Small Town TV series with Lookout Point TV and Kathy Burke, who's a legend. And I can't yet reveal anything, but I'm very happy with working with these people on the thing that might happen.
Mm-hmm. Or might not. We won't commit.
It might not happen, but we're all the happy signs are happy. All the good signs are smiling.
But it's not off the table. It's still on the table.
No, it's not. I'm not allowed to say anything, or I can't, you know, whatever you say nothing.
Coming in 2022.
So, like, anyway, it would be so amazing to see Magella on screen should that happen, if things go incredibly well.
Have you anyone in your mind that you'd like to play her?
You see, honestly, for Magella, I think she'd have to be a complete unknown and just give it socks and wellies, because I think you'd need to be just going for it. I would love to see Kevin McAleer in it, because he's like so
close. In everything, I mean, really.
He's like, oh, the most Tyrone man ever. I mean, oh my God, I'm just feeling him right now. I love Kevin. He actually, just before the pandemic, he was doing a show in Dublin and we'd got tickets. It was supposed to be for my birthday. And I was like, oh, this is why we moved back to Ireland, because you could see Kevin McAleer and almost touch him on stage. And then no, coronavirus wiped Kevin's gig off my calendar alone. See, why am I talking about that rather than all the other, you know, big gigs that got cancelled, you know, like the Edinburgh Book Festival? I'm like, I didn't get to go real close to Kevin McAleer. Anyway, no. So Big Girl, Small Town is in development, but I can't say too much more because they've made me sign things.
Brilliant. Well, listen, thank you very much for joining us. We'll end on that happy note of things to come.
That's a happier note to end on.
Guys, so Factory Girls. It was so nice chatting to you. Do you need to do a nice out? Should I shut up for a minute and we have to be like all professional again?
Absolutely. Okay. Well, no, I'm never professional when I do this.
Do,
and I'll probably leave this part in where I'd say I'm not professional. I manage to mess it up every time, usually our websites. But Factory Girls is available now from all good bookshops. Antonia's bookstore in Trim, Woodbine Books in Kilcullen, and the Maynooth Bookshop. If you like what you hear, like and share, you can contact us on atalofthreeindies@gmail.com, or just DM one of us on Twitter. I'm sure we'll answer at some point. Michelle, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.